Hey, Wild Ducks. Welcome to our technology podcast. It's my pleasure to introduce you to our host, Jerry Cuomo.
Hey, folks. Jerry here, and welcome to the Wild Ducks podcast. I think we have a great one in store for you today. And it starts some time ago. In fact, if I look back, way back, on my 40-ish year career as a software engineer, I would say that many of those memories have gotten quite fuzzy, but there's one memory in particular that is crystal clear, and that is the moment that I got bit by the software bug. So let me tell you a little bit about what was happening. I was at the T.J. Watson Research Center in Yorktown Heights, New York, that's IBM, and I was working as a part-time student in the physics department on the night shift. And one of the cool things was they allowed everyone, including students, to take the employee education courses. So if you found one you liked, you were welcome to take it. That paired with the fact that my dad had recently just brought home the first IBM PC. I thumbed through that course and I found something that struck my interest. And it was Introduction to Programming with Corel the Robot. And what was there not to like? It had robot in it. Well, folks, today's guest is the very teacher that I had of that class. His name is Brent Halpern, and I am thrilled to have him with us today. So today, full circle, I'm here with Brent, my first programming teacher. Brent, if you can believe that. And one of the people who I blame in a very happy way that lit that spark in me so many years ago. Brent, welcome to Wild Ducks.
Thank you, Jerry. I'm really looking forward to this.
All right. So let's start. A few reflective questions, if you can set the stage. And I'll quickly ask you these now, but you can take them in stride. What led you to T.J. Watson research in the mid-80s? What was your own background in software and research at the time? And then how did you end up teaching this class? How did you end up teaching programming at Watson? So fill us in a little bit. Set the stage, if you don't mind.
Sure, I'll try. Cut me off if I start waxing too eloquent here or just going on droning too long. I knew for a long time that I wanted to be a mathematician.
Okay.
Not sure why, but that just seemed to be the thing I wanted to do. I did my undergraduate degree in mathematics and along the way picked up a minor in computer science. Now, this was the University of Denver, is a small private college, or at least it was then. Mm-hmm. And computer science was basically a little assembly language on a Nova mini computer. I think there may have been some Algol or Fortran or something. Okay. And then when I wanted to go to graduate school, I applied to both math and computer science school because I didn't know which I wanted to do. And through some excellent advice from one of my professors, I applied to Stanford. Mm-hmm. I got in, which in hindsight was a miracle. And that was 4 or 5 years, amazing years at Stanford. Turned out I had like no aptitude for algorithms.
Okay.
and numerical analysis, I got through. And AI just, boy, was...
Oh, back then.
A struggle.
Yeah, back then it was rough.
Yeah. I mean, it, in some sense, it was far more disciplined in that it was, you know, there was image recognition and speech recognition and, you know, game theory kind of things. The Checkers program was a big deal. I mean, it's a computer could play checkers, but each one had its own underlying formalism. You kind of had to learn them all.
That's right.
So there's a bunch of parts that I could do but didn't enjoy, but somehow software and programming languages and where I finally ended up in program verification really got exciting to me. So mixing programs and logic and that kind of stuff. And so when I graduated, I was either going to do program verification or concurrency.
Right.
Because that was the kind of two halves.
Right. Now it's the early 80s now, right?
Yeah. So it's like 1980. I mean, it's about as early as you can get. Yeah, 79 to be, you know, close to early 80s. So, yeah. And I applied to both universities and industry labs. Mm-hmm. And got offers at Bell Labs and at TJ Watson and at a few universities, and finally decided that if I went to a university, I would stay at universities because that was just kind of like the path I was on.
Yeah, yeah.
Where if I went to industry and I didn't like it, I could always go back to a university environment. So I ended up choosing TJ Watson. I ended up in a concurrency group, building a concurrent BLSI design machine. I don't know if you remember the wire routing machine.
I mean, vaguely, I didn't work on it, but I mean, I didn't use it, but I knew of it for sure.
And none of that really happened because it turns out programming the thing was being done in assembly language. And that's the way a lot of programming was done back in those days.
I dabbled a bit, but it sure gives you an appreciation when you go up, you know, higher levels, you know, what it's like to live below the surface.
Absolutely.
So and so now you're at a storied place. I mean, to say the least, TJ Watson back in the 80s, like wasn't Fran Allen there and folks
Fran
like that?
Allen and John Cock and, you know, just people that would win Turing Awards, people that were IBM fellows, kind of like you ended up. And I, in all honesty, didn't understand how wonderful it was until I was already kind of beyond being at that wonderful stage.
I have to just, it was a story place. And again, I at that time was just, you know, exiting high school into college, and I had landed a part-time job at TJ Watson in the physics department doing real menial labor. I mean, it was just a very basic job, and it was the night shift, so it was after work. But I kind of walked the hallways when it was dark and kind of looked around, and I was like, wow, there's something's going on here. And I also, Brent, remember just anytime I needed advice, you know, I was just a student. I would find myself later on, only like maybe a decade or so later, realizing whose office I was in. Like the person who created the math library for the mainframe and people like that. And actually worked on a random number generator that I hear was used by Mandelbrot himself. So like walking the hallway, you know, it's just an amazing place. So then how did you end up teaching there? And I know you said you had an academic background. There was a program go ahead.
Yeah, so no, I really enjoyed teaching when I was a graduate student and thought I was good at it. Not sure, but it was something I enjoyed doing, which was my criteria at the time. Mm-hmm. And one of my office mates, one of the students the same year as I was, again, some amazing colleagues, was a guy named Rich Pattis. And he was doing AI while I was then doing programming languages and software. Mm-hmm. We didn't call it software engineering then, but that's probably just a Stanford peculiarity. Rich had been at CMU as an undergraduate and had picked up on turtle programming and decided he wanted to really use that to teach an intro to programming languages. So he wrote Carol the Robot, which was the book that I wanted to start with, because it would allow people to learn the basic concepts. And for them, basic concepts were iteration and if then else, you know, and stuff like that.
I tell you, from a student, and you know, I was punching way above my weight class to be in that room with you teaching at that time, and just to get like little things when they clicked, like you can create a routine to go right by going left three times or something. Mm-hmm. Things like that. And then you can call it something, go left, and then boom, you call it once and it's doing that behind. And it was blowing my mind. Like, wow, this is so powerful. And as I said, boy, if there was a spark, it was happening there. That book, I hold it, and when I teach at North Carolina State University, I hold it up and said, "This is the moment." And what a great opportunity to have the guy here to chat.
Well,
so Brent, let's talk about the discipline behind programming, because again, that spark, to this day, when I speak to people, I can't help but to try to think in modular form and, you know, think in bits and try to reuse those things, et cetera. So there's something that has been deeply instilled in me starting from that class, the art of programming, design, architecture, engineering, testing, all of those disciplines. Talk to us a little bit about the art of programming.
Well, so at that time, programming, I would now call programming in the small. It was you writing a program from scratch. And as you well know now, no serious program gets written from scratch anymore.
Right,
it's always
an
adaptation or an extension of something else.
Yeah.
Or it's built on a set of libraries that somebody designed for the numerical analysis part of the UI or what. But this was, you know, kind of like
Can we record another follow-on podcast saying something like the last unique line of code was written in 1989 or something like that.
not with me, but you know, get Grady Booch and he'll talk about that. So the big issues then were in the imperative world, the kind of conventional programming language was, you know, structured programming. Go-to's considered harmful was a very famous article about you shouldn't be using go-to's, you should be using structures. And that grew into object-oriented programming and things like that. But that was one threat. Then there were the people doing Lisp and functional programming, which were not taken seriously, at least in the IBM world, beyond a small group doing a Lisp VM under Mark Wegman.
Let's kind of maybe fast forward. We're talking about the discipline. We're talking about the people, I would say in many cases, legendary people around programming. So as a listener, I hope you're appreciating that this is a discipline. I mean, this is something we built careers on. But now enter AI code assistants. So I'd like to end this discussion here by talking about where we are today and where that might be going to in the future. Hindrance, et cetera. So let's whip up that conversation.
So in one sense, it's just another tool. From a principal's point of view, if you're working in an integrated development environment that has a good understanding of your language, you know that's really great because you will not be making all the stupid syntax errors. It will catch it as you're writing it. And changing variable names and refactoring all becomes automated. So all those things are good.
Yeah.
Unless you want somebody to understand how they're done, in which case you need to work without them to see the benefit for them and how they might be better or worse.
Right.
The way I look at the LLM-based AI assistance is, rather than you having to figure out what sort algorithm you're going to use or the details of it or whatever piece of code you're going to write, you describe what it is and then search the world of what other people have written and then pull in an implementation. But the reality is with any programming, how do you handle when it doesn't work? So, I mean, that would be my next step.
Yeah. And I, as a person who's fell out of the syntax of particular frameworks, particular languages like Python, I now feel liberated
because I can act as a conductor, an orchestrator, mm-hmm. and I can sit there and I can say, like, I would like it this way. But I also have some level of background to look at it and cast judgment. Do I like this?
Yep.
Why don't I like this? What have I seen in my past that would cause me to want to do something different, besides the fact that it may not be working? And then what do you do?
Well,
yeah,
So again, it comes down to, what are you optimizing for? If you're mm-hmm. writing a script or writing a program to be run once or a handful of times, doing it in Python, doing it in, you know, with the help of an assistant, pulling mm-hmm. something off of Stack Overflow, who cares? I mean,
That's right.
The point is to get the job done.
That's right.
If you're doing it to prototype something, again, probably not a big deal, though. You may want to think a little bit more about the design and the software engineering, because you're testing the concept in a context, not just by itself. Mm-hmm. And finally, if you're writing something that's going to run on millions of processors or for dozens of years, you need to be a lot more careful. Today, I would hate to use anything like that, like the AI assistants, beyond the prototyping stage, because the technical debt that you're including is stuff that you don't know that you're including. At least if you're writing it yourself, you can make a decision. Okay, I know I'm never going to use something bigger than this size. I know that I can get away with an N squared algorithm where I know an N log N exists. Whatever, you can make a conscious choice and realize that you're buying some technical debt on there. If you take somebody else's code uncritically, and this is going to have a long life, which is a big if for a lot of code, you're buying debt that you don't know what it's worth. And that's where I think is the first problem. The second is going to be debugging. If you don't understand how the code's written, debugging, it's a royal pain.
Oh boy. Yeah. All right. So we're just about out of time. It's amazing, Brent, just such a wonderful career. I recently retired from the very IBM that I started from, as did you. And to look back and to trace back from that very moment, that class, and the fact that we still know each other and we still talk is pretty cool. So from really sincerely, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for being part of that spark.
Well, Jerry.
Yeah.
you are welcome, but thank you, because I followed your career again up to becoming an IBM fellow and being responsible. So thank you too.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you everyone for joining, and we'll talk soon.